We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, the third in our edition looking at local election winners, I'm delighted to be joined by Scott Cunliffe, the recently elected Green Party councillor for Cliviger with Worthshawn on Burnley Council. Welcome to the podcast, Scott.
Thank you, Will.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to stand as the Green Party's candidate at the most recent set of local elections?
Well, fortunately, in Burnley, we have a very dedicated Green team that's mm-hmm. and it's dedicated to winning elections. Not all Greens are dedicated to winning elections. They have other causes and other means and priorities, but in Burnley, we're definitely dedicated to winning elections and to winning more seats on the council. So that's what struck to me, where to put my energies. It was very clear that we need more Greens in the room. And mm-hmm. Burnley was doing that, which was fantastic to have that in my own backyard.
Yeah. Was there something in particular that drew you towards the Green Party, that made you believe that the Green Party were the right party to be represented at a local level?
The only party not greenwashing. I've been a Green sort of pretty much all my adult life and worked on a few environmental projects and worked, you know, in Indonesia for 10 years in East Timor and worked for different UN bodies and things. So to see the Green Party back home actually get some momentum and just have really clear thought out policies, not just on the planet, but on people and the combination of the intersectional between people and planet as well. Now's the time. It's now or never, isn't it? To sort of make a really good contribution to the future of the planet and all of those people that live on it. So, it was always clear in my eyes. I've never thought about joining any other party really since I became involved in politics when I was a student.
Now, one of the things that has been particularly noticeable in this set of elections is how well the Green Party has done across the country in comparison to the Labour Party, for example. Why do you think that there have been, at this most recent set of local elections, more voters switching from Labour to the Green Party?
Clearly disenfranchised by traditional parties. In Burnley, I took a long-standing Tory seat. I think the only other party that's ever won a seat in my ward is the BNP. So we're not just taking off Labour. We've taken four seats off Labour and one off the Conservatives now in a rural ward. So clearly disenfranchisement with local parties and a lot of swing voters out there, you know, that are looking for a different option and are just fed up with the tradition and British politics in general.
Do you think that part of the reason that the Greens have seen this increase in support is not just because of disenfranchisement, but because of the whole coronavirus situation, the state of the environment and the way in which the planet is run has perhaps been brought home to more people, and maybe some of those people have decided, well, vote for the Green Party?
Yeah, I think people have got the thinking caps on. We've always had the thinking caps on, but, you know, it's always a difference, isn't it, between people who sort of vote in their own interest or vote for the other interest. But there's definitely a merger between that now, where they're seeing that their future and their kids' and grandchildren's future is definitely being impacted by the climate and everything that needs mitigating from that heating of the planet. So, yeah, it's kind of mainstream now, isn't it, really? I mean, it's not like every party in this local election was protecting green space or, you know, it was out front of their leaflets, whether they were in our area at least, whether they were Lib Dems or Tories or Green, they're all putting it out front, or Labour as well. But, I think people are going, well, actually, these guys have been consistent with this for decades, and maybe now it's their time. So if that's what their persuasion is, to think, hey, listen, this this planet emergency, this climate and ecological emergency is true, and we're seeing it now. You know, it's well in the mainstream, isn't it? You know, sort of Attenborough, God bless him, has not sort of been on it for years, and he's just finally got on it. So it's kind of, it's even people like that who haven't really been outspoken, even though they've had the finger on the pulse. So that's really into mainstream consciousness now. So people are thinking about it, and that's good. First step.
Now that you've been elected to the council, what are your main aims in terms of things that you want to put forward to improve your particular ward, but also things that you want the council as a whole to do?
Well, I think the first main aim for us is to get more Greens elected. We have 5 out of 45 seats on Birmingham Council now, and we're in opposition to a Labour and Lib Dem coalition. And so hold them to account on definitely on climate change. We, like many councils around the country, declared a climate emergency, which was obviously pushed by us. But I don't seem to act on that all that much. So at the first meeting, even the sort of, you know, the plastic bottles are out on the table. And so actually holding them to account to actually get carbon literate. I think it'd be great to actually get council staff and council members and especially those on the exec to become carbon literate, because I don't think they are actually carbon literate as we stand. They've said they're going to have, the exec in Birmingham Council said they're going to have climate change as a mitigator, as a cross-cutting issue on all of the exec positions. So, yes, we've got to hold them to task on that. In the more medium term, hopefully we can change this into better council system, that we go away from exec to a more committee system. I think that would be a little bit better for opening up democracy on Burnley Council.
Do you think, I mean, you talked about carbon literacy there. Do you think that part of the problem simply is that people might be aware of, you know, like the polar ice caps melting, for example, but they aren't aware of some of the more basic things that you can do to ensure that you're cutting your carbon footprint, or indeed eradicating it completely? Do you think that that's something that, in terms of education, needs to be put forward more?
Yeah, for sure. And I think on a local council, it's not too difficult, because the powers are quite restricted on a local council. So let's take planning or in Burnley's the Development Control Committee. That's in charge of planning, overseeing planning on new builds. And so take that literacy and put it towards planning. And what does that mean? So breaking down the carbon content of new builds, and then breaking down a new build into the carbon content of plasterboard, which most people know has got probably more carbon in it than actually the bricks and mortar. But breaking all that down, I mean, everyone's got bricks and mortar around them. Everyone's putting plasterboard in the house, but they don't really know that... how big a piece of the pie all that is. So it's, I mean, it's stuff that people can relate to, because it's right in front of them. They live in the house. So I'm sure the councillors can relate to that. I mean, it's not rocket science, really. And you don't have to understand the science of it. You just have to understand the numbers and go, hey, if we want to mitigate and be a council that's pushing ahead to mitigate, you know, sort of, or get to carbon zero, then this is one way of doing it. So you take that across licensing as well, and the other committees, and because the powers are quite restricted, aren't they? So it's quite a narrow carbon literacy that would need to be put onto that narrow set of powers. Hopefully, local councils will have more powers in the future. But that's why we need to get more Greens in the room.
We're going to take a short break now to listen to the Politics of Sound podcasts episode with Edwina Curry. When we get back, myself and Scott will continue to discuss what he thinks that the Green Party can do in local government, the issue of housing, whether the Chesham and Amersham by-election was in part won for the Liberal Democrats because of their seeming promise to build fewer houses in the constituency, in parts of the constituency, the implications of HS2, HS3, and much more. We'll be back very shortly.
Do you want to see your politicians from a different angle? It's time for the Politics of Sound podcast. I believe that people's record collections can reveal a lot about them, and so every month I invite politicians and political figures to reveal their three all-time favourite albums, and in exchange, I want to know all about them and their lives, what they think, and why they think it. Joining me in the record shop this month is the former junior health minister, author, and media personality, Edwina Curry. So why not join me, Ian Carnegie, my guests, and the house band on the Politics of Sound podcast, out now on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you mentioned planning there, and planning, of course, has been one of the major issues in the most recent by-election at Chesterfield and Amersham, where the Lib Dems beat the Conservatives, partly, it seemed, by advocating perhaps for less house building and being opposed to HS2. Is house building and planning regulations something that you really want to focus on to ensure that houses, when they are built, are, you know, creating more pollution in the environment and are doing so in a way that doesn't damage the natural environment of local areas?
Yeah, for sure. You know, like on my ticket, I stood on the ticket of protecting green spaces. I'm in a rural area, and there's obviously, not obviously to you guys, but there's an awful lot of new housing slated on the local plan in Burnley for in this rural area. So you can link that back to a Tory policy of building more middle class houses everywhere. And so it's definitely something that's got to be taken seriously. And when you've got an awful lot of older houses that need retrofitting and need to become energy efficient, and the whole push towards electric in housing, not just in cars, then there's definitely an awful lot of education that needs to go into that planning policy. And if there is to be a new planning policy, which we're told there will be, then it definitely needs to incorporate the recommendations of the climate sort of committee. And it also needs to be very democratic and allow people to actually voice their opinions as well, which is the other threat that might be taken away if we are to believe what Boris said in his Queen's speech.
Do you think, though, that there's a concern, given that there is a housing crisis, that some people may say, you know, well, why isn't it that you aren't just building more houses to alleviate the housing crisis and to get more people on the housing ladder? Isn't it a detriment to society large that perhaps you're placing emphasis more on particular rural areas rather than people who need homes and would be able to generate something for the local economy? I mean, what would you say to someone who makes that kind of argument?
Yeah, I think as a Green, we'd never say that we're against development. We're in favour of appropriate development in the right places at the right time. And for sure, definitely, if there is a housing shortage in each area per area, I mean, we've got a dwindling population in Burnley going down slowly. So, and do we want to attract more people? Do we want to look after the people that are currently here or strike that balance right? Yeah. So you look at the brown site areas and how much sort of empty space there is and how much land is kind of locked up and not being developed on. So that's where the focus should be, and actually, you know, just putting a bit more effort in, you know, for the council to put a bit more effort in to solve these tricky land issues and problems in the brown areas so that you can build on those rather than it's just an easy option, isn't it? There's a greenfield, farmer's in decline, he wants to get a couple of million for his plot of land, win-win for them. It's easy for the council, easy for the farmer who wants out a bit, and hey ho, there you go, and sort of local residents pushed aside. And do we want to keep it rural? Do we want to protect those green spaces, biodiversity, everything that goes with it that everyone enjoys? You know, let's start talking about physical and mental fitness as well, and the role rural areas play in all of that. So, you know, we've got a pandemic and we've got a mental health pandemic and all these things. So protecting those green areas is massively important for people going forward, especially when you've got brown areas that can be built on.
One of the other things that has attracted a great deal of consternation debate has been HS2 and the extension to HS2, the proposed extension to HS2, the Northern Powerhouse Rail, also known as HS3, has come under suggestions by the Prime Minister and members of the government that HS3 might not be built, because of the anger over HS2 in certain quarters, that HS3 may not be created. Do you think that if HS3 isn't created, that will make a negative impact on the economy of the north of England? Or do you think that it would be better not to go ahead with HS3?
Good question. I mean, maybe a bit above my pay grade, all of that, really. In the sense of, when I'm looking at my local economy and I'm looking at my connectionness, and this is an open debate within the Green Party, yeah, there's people that are pro and against and have got good grounded reasons on both sides, so I'm quite undecided, to be honest. But when I'm looking at my local economy and the interconnectedness on local transport, from smaller towns like ours into bigger cities or bigger bigger urban areas, I think that needs to be, highly part of this debate, and not just like, how do we connect the big cities together? I'm quite happy that I can jump on a train and go from Manchester to London in 2.5 hours. I don't really see the need to do it in two. I'd love for to be a direct train from Burnley to Manchester. There isn't one. Well, it goes through the Tottenham loop, but it's quicker to get the bus. So bringing in all of those things, the connectivity between small towns, because this is where the red wall is, or the crumbling red wall. This is where the voters are. It's not just Manchester or Leeds. It's the smaller towns that have just been left by the wayside. So where's our connectivity to all of this? So HS2, HS3, HS4, what's it going to give to us, really? Get me a better public transport system from Burnley to Leeds and Burnley to Manchester and all those places, or better bike path. Chicken dinner for me, that would be.
Now, one of the other issues that has come up of late is putting more effort into improving greener energy and the accessibility to greener energy, and also making sure that there are more green jobs. Is there a particular part of the green energy sector that you would like to see potentially more emphasis put on and more work done into recruiting people into that particular sector? And do you think that there is a particular green energy sector that might be able to provide jobs and work in Burnley?
Burnley's got a tradition of engineering. Further back, it's got a tradition of cotton and weaving and... I think we can forget about coal now, even though we've got a tradition in coal in the past. But yeah, for sure. So I think there's a highly skilled labour force that currently does work in engineering, whether that's automobile or aerospace, in the various factories in and around. And the Barnoldswick Rolls-Royce factory's taken quite a bit of news recently, potential calls down. It's eventually staying open. Unions have lobbied hard. So you've got a very good sort of engineering base in Burnley. So, we were just hearing yesterday, potentially an opening of a battery factory in Sunderland. Fantastic news for those people up in the northeast. And we've got Toyota subsidiary in Burnley. We're waiting to hear what their sort of latest move is towards fully electric cars or hydrogen or whatever they're going to be putting forward, and how that might affect us. I'm laughing to myself, but I just wonder where's the council at with this? Where's the exec at with this? And how far proactive are they being in attracting these green industries? And be like, £1 trillion is the automobile industry, green automobile industry, globally worth going forward. All we need to get is a few components of that, and we're winning. And we've got the base, we've got the factories, we've got the workers. So who's going out there doing the legwork for Burnley and other towns of Burnley's ilk? To actually bring in those components to be part of that supply chain. And you can look at the supply chain and go, okay, there's less components in an electric car than there was in a diesel car or in a gas car. But you're kind of like You've got to take that opportunity. We've got a massive opportunity now, which is why I think a lot of people are also waking up to the green sort of possibility, because they're seeing that, hey, this is not just an inconvenient truth that the public is going to be inconvenienced with. It's actually a massive opportunity for us to build up industries, whatever that might be, you know, around that and harness that. But you've got to have people proactive and working to attract it into your town, and the education facilities have got to mirror that potential.
Mm. Going back to the Green Party in general, what do you think is the future of the Green Party, and where do you see it going in the future in terms of electoral success?
Good question. I mean, it's obviously you can't talk about the future of Green Party in Britain without talking about PR or a change to the electoral system and how much that would be a fairer system for more than two parties just throwing egg and chips at each other across the aisle, you know. So we're highly dependent on that, and that needs to be strategized quite well, you know, and we're coming up to new elections, and how's that going to work? And, you know, would it be a Green that would have more chance of beating a Tory in Burnley, or would it be a Labour candidate? And who's the best candidate? And would they come in with us if they recognise that the Greens have got a better candidate than Labour? So all these coalition buildings and things, let's start talking. I think the good thing about the Green Party is that we do talk to people, as doors always open. I think we were the first ones to reach out to Labour and send a letter straight away saying, doors open, you know, when you're building your coalition because you don't have a majority on Burnley Council, come on in, talk to us. They didn't do this time, but maybe in the future they will do. So I think, yes, cooperation and collaboration for the Greens going forward is a massive part of our strategy in getting us more seats in Westminster, which I think is what, you know, we've shown we're doing well in councils and improving all the time. Our membership's growing. I think we're almost at 50K now. So, you know, that's all boding well. But how do we crack into Westminster? That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah. Is there a particular set of policies or particular ideas that you'd like to see in the next Green Party general election manifesto? Or are you just happy to see what's presented and what is part of the manifesto when it's published at the next election?
As green can be, I think. You know, it's obviously, there's culture wars going on. There's a lot of other issues that are clouding politics, causing confusion, causing division. And we've got to be able to answer those questions, but we've also got to be able to keep focusing on that green opportunity that's out there, focusing on the green economy and the importance of the next 10 years. Because I think a lot of Greens don't really want to be in politics. It's like, it's now or never, isn't it, really? So I don't want to be a politician. I'll be truthful with you. But there's no choice now, is there, really? You know, like, it's come to this where we've seen how when you've got a pandemic or an emergency crisis in your face and people are dropping like flies from it, how people react and rally around and move forward. If you're looking at the climate emergency and the ecological emergency in the same breath as you have done the COVID pandemic, then it's time for action. And we all know, you know, we've pretty much got 10 years to get this ship sailing in the right way. Otherwise, we failed, haven't we?
Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to speak to you, Scott, and I have one final question. We've discussed the coronavirus pandemic somewhat. We've talked about it in a little bit of great detail, but things appear at the moment to be getting better with the rollout of the vaccination programme, and hopefully in the near future things will be back to a state of normal life as it was pre-pandemic. So what one thing that you haven't been able to do because of the pandemic are you most looking forward to being able to do again when things are back to normal?
Well, personally,
yeah,
I think travel always opens your mind, but I'm also very I've just fallen in love so much with my hometown and the nature and the beauty around here. I don't really see much of a reason to leave at the moment. I think it's made me look maybe more inwardly, but just, I mean, my dad's got Alzheimer's, and just being able to get out and do a few more things with him and stuff you know, and enjoy sort of life without having to tell him to put his mask on. And that's just that's priceless, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. And meet more of my colleagues in the Green Party and the Green Movement, and but not be talking on Zoom and all the time, and be able to just have a good group hug.
Yeah, I'm sure myself and all the people listening will hope that you'll be able to do that soon, Scott. For people listening who might want to follow what you're doing in Burnley at the moment or get in touch, what can they do to find you online? Where can they get in touch with you and follow what you're doing as a Green councillor?
I have quite a long-winded Facebook page, but if you want to get in touch with me, on Twitter, it's at SEKOTT. Probably tweet more about football than I do green politics, but there you go. You can DM me and there we go. I don't do too much on Twitter politics-wise, but yeah, try to get my hands dirty down on the ground a bit more. But yeah, at SEKOTT, you can reach me on Twitter on there or on, what's it called, Instagram as well. My DMs are open, as they say.
Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Scott.
Thanks, Will. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.